Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Adam. Welcome to the 39th episode of Robots.
In today's show, we'll be speaking with two experts in robot learning. Andrea Thomas from Georgia Tech in the US looks at how humans teach and robots learn, with the hope to create good human-robot interactions. We then speak with Sethu Vijayakumar from the University of Edinburgh about machine learning and how it can teach a robot hand to balance a pole. But first, as always, let's hear the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thanks, Sabine. Unbeknownst to us, a team of forensic pathologists just an hour's drive away at the University of Bern in Switzerland are working on making a robot part of their standard autopsy procedure. The team has pioneered virtual autopsies, or vertopsies, which use non-invasive imaging of a body instead of the radical postmortem surgery typically used to determine cause of death. This has a long list of advantages, including mitigating the risk of overlooking something in what is now a one-shot investigation with no chance for re-evaluation, replacing the current practice of verbal descriptions prone to misinterpretation with a more reliable and standardized method, and allowing for a more tactful approach relying on modern 3D imaging and needle biopsies, leaving the body intact. Vertobot can help with much of this process by precisely moving a scanner, building up an accurate 3D picture, or by performing an accurate needle biopsy during a live CT scan without the need to expose pathologists to any radiation. Vertobot has already been used in 52 real cases, including 26 road deaths, 10 by impacts from a blunt object, 6 knifings, 5 shootings, and 2 throttlings. Three researchers from the Research and Engineering Center for Unmanned Vehicles in Colorado have created their own robot version of the old video game classic Pac-Man to illustrate the performance of their UAV software suite. It consists of a labyrinth drawn on the floor and 5 Roomba vacuum cleaner robots. The player can navigate the Pac-Man Roomba through the labyrinth using a joystick while avoiding the other 4 Roombas and gaining points by vacuuming up paper scraps. Just like in the real game, a power pellet allows Pac-Man to chase its opponent's ghosts and send them packing. Finally, with the year 2009 slowly but surely drawing to an end, magazines are starting to compile their best of 2009 lists, featuring some of this year's most memorable robots. Popular Science magazine's annual list of top 100 innovative products includes 2 robots. The whisker-sensing Scratchbot, which we just discussed in detail in our episode on Active Touch, and Robin Murphy's Survivor Buddy, which robots featured as part of its Best of 2008 list. Time magazine's list of 50 best inventions includes 3 robots. A cyborg beetle, developed at the University of Berkeley, and the world's first robot fashion model, HRP4C, which you may both remember from previous Robots news, as well as Festo's robot penguin, which was the topic of our podcast on animals and automation this July. For more information on the autopsy-performing Vertobot, a great video on the Pac-Man robot game, and to revisit some of 2009's memorable robots, have a look at the Robots Forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Thanks, Christine. Our first expert in learning is Andrea Thomas from Georgia Tech in Atlanta. Her latest humanoid robot, Simon, has been widely featured in the news recently for its beautiful figure and lovable ears. Using this robot and other ones from the Socially Intelligent Machines research lab she directs, Professor Thomas is helping robots learn from humans so that they can be used in our everyday environment. Hi, Andrea. Welcome to Robots.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Can you please present yourself to our listeners?
Sure. My name is Andrea Thomas. I'm an assistant professor in interactive computing at the Georgia Institute of Technology.
What's the goal of your lab? Tell us a bit about your lab.
Yeah, my lab is the Socially Intelligent Machines Lab, and the goal of our lab is building social robots in general. So we focus mainly on human-robot interaction and thinking about how to make robots more able to naturally interact with the people that they might be doing tasks with.
A lot of your research has to do with humans teaching robots new skills. Why is it important to teach robots new skills?
Yeah, so one of the main aspects of human-robot interaction that my lab is thinking about is social learning. So we're interested in everyday people being able to teach new tasks and skills to a robot, mainly because we and a lot of other people think that it is going to be impossible to pre-program robots that are going to be useful out in the world because the human environments are just dynamic places, and humans in general, adding a human to an environment makes it a very dynamic environment that is hard to plan for in advance. So you can't really imagine being a robot designer and pre-programming a robot to do everything in someone's home that it's going to need to do. What you might be able to imagine doing is pre-programming a basic set of behaviors that then the person that owns the robot would be able to teach the robot exactly how to use those behaviors in the context of their home.
What would be an ideal human-robot teaching scenario?
An ideal teaching scenario? Well, so, the one that that we think about is the case where the robot maybe has a basic set of behaviors, like some simple object manipulation skills, for example. And what the human is trying to do is teach some higher-level task, some goal-oriented task, like something that I want the robot to do with all of the objects. And so this is an interesting problem because it gets to the representation of how you determine what's important about that task. So how does the robot decide that it's this particular change to these objects that the human is trying to get me to understand. So putting away the dishes from the dishwasher is really about the dishwasher being empty at the end and all of the dishes being in the cabinet. It doesn't really matter whether it was cups or plates or saucers that I had to put away.
Let's look at a concrete example with one of the experiments you did in your lab where you had basically a human teaching a robot how to interact with new objects. So first of all, how did the humans teach the robot in this scenario?
Yeah, so this was with a small little tabletop robot that we were using called Junior. And Junior was able to do just a couple of simple actions. It was able to either swing one of its arms as like kind of a sliding action, or is able to swing both of its arms in coordination like a grabbing action. And so the experiment was about how could Junior learn what's called affordances, so learning what its actions can do in the world. So you have a lot of different objects in the world, and what can this sliding and grabbing action achieve on various objects in the world? So some objects might roll when you slide them, versus some objects might just move a little bit. If an object is the right size, then the grabbing action might be able to actually lift it, but sometimes it's not the right size and you can't lift it. So things like this, we want the robot to be able to learn the things that it can do with objects in the world. And so what humans did in the experiment was present objects to the robot to let it explore its actions. So people were basically structuring the environment to provide a particular learning experience to the robot.
This input that the humans gave, how was it different from what a normal machine learning scenario would do?
Yeah, so that's one of the main questions that we were looking at was what would be different when a human was providing these learning experiences versus when a robot was, say, exhaustively exploring every possibility. So the classical machine learning case would be that you give give the robot a complete view of the state space or a representative sample of the state space, and then learn. This is when you learn some statistical regularities on that. And so what was different when people were presenting the examples, as opposed to when you were doing an exhaustive exploration of the examples, is that people focused on the rare things that happened in the world. So if you're thinking about, we had a simple set of objects. We had some colorful spheres that the robot could roll. We had a couple of cubes, like boxes, that the robot could move around and pick up. And we had a little box that the robot could take the lid off of. And so people would focus on these rare things where, you know, like a ball, for example, would have to be in a particular location with respect to the robot in order for its swinging action to make the ball roll. So a lot of times the robot could be near the ball and do its swinging action and nothing would happen. So people were really good at giving the robot a lot of experience with the rare points in the environment where something actually interesting happens.
Did anything unexpected come out of it? And did the humans do anything surprising?
So I guess the, let's see, people, sometimes, some of the surprising things were when people didn't follow the rules. The rules of the experiment were that people were supposed to present the objects to the robot one at a time, and that they were supposed to wait for the robot to finish its action and then present another example. So some people did this for a while, but then they got bored of that. And one of our favorite examples from the experiment was that a person started experimenting with the box and the lid and the lid of the box. Then she decided that the lid of the box wasn't interesting, so she was just experimenting with the box and then with the ball, and finally discovered that the robot was able to play a little simple basketball, so it could pick up the ball and kind of throw it into the box, and it could do that pretty repeatedly. So that was our most interesting rare event that one of the humans found. We were surprised that even with a very simple set of five objects, somebody found an affordance that we hadn't thought of in advance.
In this example, does knowing how the human teach actually help you design better robots?
Yeah, that's interesting. So we didn't use anything about how the human was teaching in this first experiment because we were basically running this experiment to determine what's different about the human's teaching. And then we use that for future design guidelines for how we could build a better learner. So one of the main things that we took away from this experiment was that people focus on rare things, like I mentioned, and they also structure the ordering of how examples are presented. So they would focus on one object, then they would switch to another object, and in one of their chunks of focusing on the object, they often would work with the robot until there were a series of positive examples of the affordance at the end of a chunk. So if the person was working with the robot on the ball and trying to get it to learn that the ball rolls, so they would present several examples, and the robot would maybe achieve getting the ball rolled sometimes and not achieve getting a ball rolled other times. But towards the end of that chunk of working with the ball, the human would make sure that there were several examples of the ball rolling, so actually achieving the affordance. So this is interesting from a machine learning perspective because it shows this structuring is something that in the future a robot could take advantage of and maybe not need to be given the affordances that you were looking for in advance, but be able to learn those in an unsupervised way.
Going away from the previous teacher-student scenario, you've also been looking at how robots can socially explore an environment, sort of like when kids basically are playing together. What are some of the social learning mechanisms that are found in nature which you are interested in investigating?
Yeah, so In developmental psychology, there have been a lot of people that have been looking at social learning and what the mechanisms of social learning are, both in humans and in other animals too. We're starting to see that lots of animals actually do some forms of social learning that we didn't think they did before. So There are four mechanisms that we were looking at in our research recently. One is called stimulus enhancement. So that's when a learner, if we don't necessarily think of it as teacher and learner in this sense, because we're actually thinking about peers. So like you were saying, we're thinking about the scenario of kids playing together. You find that playing just in the vicinity of another child actually changes the play process. So there's something about just being with a partner that helps. And so that's part of what we're looking at in this experiment. So stimulus enhancement is when the learner is looking at the partner and what objects they're interacting in the world, and just is motivated to interact with the same objects. And emulation is when the learner is motivated to reproduce the goals that it sees, the state changes that it sees the partner reproduce. And mimicking is when the learner is motivated to reproduce the actions that it sees the partner do, irrespective of goals or state changes. And then the last one is the one that we're all more familiar with, which is imitation, where the learner is motivated to reproduce the actions and the state changes of the partner. So basically, imitation is the most complex, and these other three are sort of lower levels of social learning that sort of lead to imitation. So we were interested in looking at imitation as well as these other three mechanisms that that are sort of subtasks of imitation.
How can this be useful for robots?
So we're interested in using these mechanisms that maybe aren't full imitation, because doing full imitation learning for a robot is hard, first of all, so because you have to do full activity recognition to understand all of the actions that the person is doing, and full perception, where you're understanding all of the state changes that are happening in the world. So a system that's only doing one or part of that is going to be a simpler system. So that's just from an engineering perspective, it's kind of interesting to see, you know, what can we get for less. And the other aspect in which this can be useful for a robot is that imitation learning requires that the teacher be doing the full demonstration. So you have to see the full action and the full state change example before you can learn from it. Whereas some of these other mechanisms let a teacher or a partner just demonstrate part of a task. So maybe just show you what objects are important to a task, or what actions are important to a task, without demonstrating the whole task. So basically, you're letting the robot take advantage of partial demonstrations of a task.
How does the robot get reward from this scenario? How can it know that it's done something good?
So we have been, in our initial experiments in this scenario, we've given the robot, similar to the junior experiment, we gave the robot a notion of what kinds of affordances or state changes in the world are interesting. So in this, looking at different social learning mechanisms, we basically told the robot that its goal is trying to learn about how to make sound in the world. So it has a bunch of objects in the workspace that it's exploring and learning about, and it knows that the interesting thing or the salient thing in the environment is that some of the objects make sound. So they have coins and noisemakers inside, and so the robot is kind of inherently motivated to try to make sound in the environment.
I wanted to keep sort of what I've seen lately for last, which is your new humanoid, Simon, which I really love. Can you first of all describe Simon to us?
Sure. We're very excited about the Simon platform. It is a upper torso humanoid robot with two arms that are each 7 degrees of freedom, and a 2 degree of freedom torso, and it has two hands that each have 4 degrees of freedom, so it can do some different grasping actions, and it can do gestures like pointing. And it has a socially expressive head, we say, in that it's not completely humanoid, so it doesn't have it doesn't have a lot of the facial features that humans have, but it has eyeballs and eyelids, and it has some creature-like ears that were designed to purposely look non-humanoid to give it sort of an other creature kind of look to it. So the ears, they each have 2 degrees of freedom, so the ears can move up and down and rotate, and they also they have LEDs inside, so they can light to a full RGB spectrum.
I really love the ears. Can you sort of give us an intuitive image of how they can be expressive?
Sure. So we're interested in ears for a number of reasons. There have been a lot of social robots in the past that have used ears as a degree of freedom, like the Kismet robot and the Leonardo robot, both at MIT. So we knew in designing those, and I had worked with the Leonardo robot before coming to Georgia Tech, so I knew that that ears were one of the most expressive things that I found with the Leonardo robot, so I wanted to definitely have the Simon robot have ears as a degree of freedom. It's an interesting degree of expression because it allows emotional expression that people are good at reading without being humanoid. So I know people like to talk a lot about the uncanny valley, which I think is ill. It's hard to define what it is, but as a concept, we try to avoid the uncanny valley by making something more creature-like than humanoid. And so the ears are something that does that. So people are really used to reading expressions like ears in animated characters, especially animals, and in pets. So it ends up being a good degree of freedom for emotional expression. And you can express a lot of things like interest and boredom and happiness and sadness. And then the lights are something that that we're just starting to play with, and it's a completely non-humanoid and non-biologically inspired degree of freedom that we can play with to see what it's good for. So that's actually sort of an open research question for us, like what kinds of expression is that degree of freedom good for?
We interviewed Professor Weinberg a while back, who made this beautiful drummer robot, and now there's this beautiful Simon robot, and I'm wondering, what's the secret at Georgia Tech to make a good-looking robot?
Well, we definitely have a sense that design is important. I know that for designing the Simon robot, we had an industrial designer involved from the beginning. So we worked with Mecha Robotics, is a robotics company that built the whole robot. And they had the specifications of the torso and the arms already set. And then we found an industrial designer that was a visiting professor at Georgia Tech last year. Her name is Carla Diana. And she worked together with us to define the look and feel of the head, given that the torso and arms were going to be the proportions that they are. So that was a really interesting process because you have a lot of questions as to what's the right scale of the size of the head, the shape of the head, the relation of the eyes in the head form, and then we came up with the ears concept and just getting it, putting it all together. So it was a really interesting process to think about both the design and the engineering challenges. So things like, the size of the eyeballs were pretty much set by the smallest camera that we could buy to put in there. So given that we knew that eyeballs had to be a particular size and the torso was a particular size, then the rest of the head dimensions sort of came off of that.
With Simon and maybe other robots, where do you see the future of human-robot interactions?
It is so hard to make predictions, and I think that it's every roboticist's biggest fear to make a prediction into the future. But I think that the field of human-robot interaction is so interdisciplinary, and just in the last 4 or 5 years, it's really started to come together and be more of a community. There's a human robot interaction conference that has been very successful, and it's only in its fourth or fifth year. So I think that in terms of the community coming together is only going to push the research in an even stronger direction.
Thanks, Andrea, for being here with us on Robots.
Thanks very much for having me.
Sethu Vijayakumar is the head of the Statistical Machine Learning and Motor Control Group at the University of Edinburgh, where he investigates learning as it can be applied to robotics. He tells us about the similarities and differences between human and machine learning, as well as how robots can learn to perceive their environment through their physical interaction with it. Hi, Sethu. Welcome to Robots Podcast.
Hi, Adam. I'm very glad to be talking to you from Edinburgh.
Can you quickly tell us what is learning, other than, us sitting at a desk and writing down math equations from the board when our teacher shows us?
So I think learning can be described and expressed at various levels. So it can be anything from basic mimicking of either actions or behaviors or intentions to something much more deeper, where you extract the essence of something that's being shown to you, or you pick it up on the way, and you, what we call generalize, meaning you apply this knowledge to more widespread, generic concepts and situations. So, for example, if you're learning about a concept, for example, maths, as in a classroom environment, then you while you observe a person solving something, you do not specifically concentrate on the particular sums that are being done, but actually the concept of things like additions and subtraction, multiplication, for example. So, I think the holy grail of learning is actually being able to generalize from observations to adapt to new situations, be able to be very reactive to new situations and environments. And this can apply to a wide range of things, from robotics to machine learning to prediction to healthcare to environmental studies. It's about taking what's there out there in the world, the knowledge through large number of sensors and data acquired through a long history of data collection, and then processing it in a way such that you can get robots or any sort of physical objects that you want to control, or say any prediction mechanisms to actually tell you what you ask. Yeah, I think at the University of Edinburgh, the specific aspects of learning we're interested in is how we can get high-dimensional robotic systems like humanoid robotic systems or anthropomorphic systems, things which have a humanoid form, to be able to do tasks reliably, robustly, and with the same level of dexterity as humans. So going away from the traditional concepts of programming robots using very prescribed sequence of movements and using something like PD control to control it, and going beyond that and going into something like here's some demonstration, here's a collection of what are called good movements and bad movements, and can you now extract intelligent and appropriate concepts from it, and then use tools from machine learning and maths and physics and all the machinery behind it to now generalize to novel concepts, for example.
So what about machine learning that you're talking about? How is it How does it compare with human learning? Because we all kind of learn throughout our lives. What are the maybe the things that are the same as well as the things that are different in machine learning?
Right. It's a very difficult question to answer conclusively. But I think to begin with, I must say that one of the aims of machine learning or learning in general is to try and go towards abilities and the versatilities of human learning capabilities. And I think in doing that, we are trying to say equip automatic acquisition systems with the ability and the versatility to learn like humans. So to answer your question more directly, the machine learning concepts or artificial learning is mostly dealing with here's a bunch of sensors, here's a bunch of pre-prescribed, pre-selected inputs that come in, and I have very specific tasks in mind that I need to perform with a certain level of goodness. And again, this goodness criterion is pre-specified by you. So you tell the system what is acceptable behavior and what is not. And this is in the sort of machine learning or maths lingo, it's mostly called optimization functions or cost functions. So you typically pre-specify that. Whereas in human learning, it's more like you use a variety of sources, a variety of sensors, and you may add or drop sensors on the fly. For example, if I'm watching somebody do tennis or watching somebody, say, cut some vegetables or whatever, I do not have a preconceived notion of saying I should look at this person's wrist or I should look at a particular set of sensors, the velocity of the knife or the spin, the pose of the racket. This is something you pick up and decide on the fly. It's mostly this selection is mostly driven by your performance. So you end up trying this thing, and you figure out, oh, the way I'm learning is probably not most optimal, and then you either adjust your cost functions or you adjust your the relevant variables that you're trying to look at in an appropriate fashion. But I think ultimately the goal or the aim of learning, both in artificial and in human-like systems, are very similar. You are trying to be able to generalize from a set of demonstrations and be able to, most importantly, react to things which you've not seen before. I think that is one of the, again, the big jumps in robotic technology control. So where learning comes in most useful is instead of saying, I program things for all possible consequences of situations I can encounter, I'd rather equip it with the facility to develop these capabilities of generalization on the fly. Yeah.
Can you maybe give us a more specific example of robotic learning? One of your recent robots, such as the hand robot that manages to balance a stick, and how you achieve this, maybe describe the experiment and how you achieved it and how learning came in useful as opposed to another technique, for example.
Okay. I think the example that you're referring to is the example where we used an anthropomorphic robot arm, anthropomorphic in the sense that it's got very similar degrees of freedom as a human hand. So it is redundant. It has roughly the same number of sort of joints, active joints, as a human hand. And we use that to, for example, learn how to balance a pole. And now balancing a pole is what we call a dynamically unstable task, meaning if you leave it as it is, then things fall apart. This is very different to, for example, moving something around using a mobile robot. If you move something and you leave it on the ground, it will potentially stay there, and you can then plan and act in a reasonable time frame. Whereas if you're trying to balance a pole, you have to be very reactive. You have to control all the time, and the moment you stop controlling, it's likely that the pole will topple over because it is dynamically unstable. So for such a task, it is quite crucial that you equip the system with an ability to learn. The reason being, it's very hard to pre-program or write programs that can, for example, account for a variety of situations, meaning different lengths of the pole, different weights, different sensor characteristics, different placement of sensors. So these are multitude of exponentially sort of infinite number of possibilities. And of course, you can approximate certain physics of the pole, but you are always left with a large number of parameters which you've not accounted for, uncertainties in, say, friction, wind or turbulence or some other forces like the Coriolis forces on your robot arm. So I think and on top of that, there is the added complication that the robot that we were using to do that was actually a hydraulic-driven robot. So the aim was, can we now do things very much like a baby would do? So we wanted to try out various actions, look at what happens to the pole as a consequence of your action. So effectively, you're learning the relationship between something that you do and how it affects the task or the object that you're controlling. And once you do that, then you can always use the machine learning techniques that we have developed, for example, in our lab and through our collaborators at other places and in the U.S. and even there are some collaborators at EPFL. We can use those techniques to internalize this relationship or store away this relationship in a parsimonious fashion. So the relationship between the consequence of a particular action you take and its effect on the object that you're controlling. So once you do that, you can then use it to, for example, control the pole or even try and explore domains or areas which has not been seen. For example, if I change the property of the pole by adding an additional weight on the top of the pole, then it changes the dynamic slightly. But if you use the right representation to store this relationship, then you can generalize relatively quickly to this new scenario. This area, this is also called transfer learning, where you basically take the knowledge that you've had of the original pole and transfer this to a slightly different pole, which has roughly the same properties, but it's different in subtle ways. So this was done using repeated trials and using data to learn this relationship between consequences and of your action. And using that to predict what should be the force that you should apply. Now, I think this experiment is particularly interesting because one would ask, why do you want a sort of pole balancing robot? Similar story, if you look at sort of the Azimo robot from Honda, you will say, why would you want to create a humanoid robot which, for example, kicks a ball or runs around in a circle? So what's the motivation behind it? Actually, the motivation behind most of these things is that by challenging robots and robotics as a domain to do these tasks, these challenging tasks, you are answering some of the important, very difficult questions like, how do you react fast? How can we get robots to react much more robustly? And how do you equip it with the ability to learn, for example, balancing or dynamic tasks, because these are the capabilities that would be required in a robot that would be, for example, used in everyday society. If you want a robot to be a carer or a helper, or if you want a robot to react to a situation in a particular way reasonably fast, then these are the basic capabilities that would be required. And we're just embodying that challenge in an interesting task, and that is all.
Well, that's really interesting. Another one of your projects, correct me if I'm wrong here, but you're looking at, it's called visual motor learning and multimodal attention. You're looking at how perception is, not just action, but perception is related to actions, and then actions are then related to the perception you have of them. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about that project and how learning
yes.
is involved?
So indeed, when you control robots, there's a whole cycle of being able to sense, use these multiple sources of information or data coming from various sources. Could be vision, could be proprioception, or it could be some sort of tactile sensors. So there are this huge number of modalities which tell you something about the state of your system, of your system, of the environment, of the object that you're trying to control. And the idea is, if you have limited resources in terms of processing this data in real time, for example, then can we use intelligent, appropriate ways of dealing with this limitation? Meaning, can we be very selective about the way we combine information in a way that is useful to the task at hand? And so this whole work on multimodal attention and cue combination is an emphasis. It has a main emphasis of finding out, again, in a data-driven fashion, what are the most relevant variables of interest for the task at hand. So, for example, if I'm this whole concept of change blindness, where if you are concentrating on a particular scene, and if you say, for example, tracking a ball or a balloon going on in a scene, and if you change some aspects of the scene, for example, if you add an extra building in the scene, or you change something much more prominent and significant, surprisingly, people fail to notice some of the big changes, because you sort of assign your resources to the things which are most relevant, or the things which are most appropriate for the task at hand, which is, for example, in this case, tracking a ball or a balloon. So I think it's the whole issue in robotics and fast sensing, fast control and reactive control is not just actuators and motion, but also how we can be smart about sensing. And be smart about sensing in which you know, you have resources which are limited, and you want to use these resources in a way that is most appropriate for the task at hand. So yeah, I think that kind of summarizes the work on sensory sort of integration, and this is also quite relevant to the work that we're doing on prosthetics. So one of the areas that we've been working with is the local Scottish company called Touch Bionics, and we've been working with their prosthetic hand, the iLimb. So these are real replacement limbs for amputees. These are upper extremities. At the moment, the limb operates in an open loop fashion, meaning when you use your EMG signals, the signals from your muscles to operate the opening and the closing of the hand, and when you grip something, then you use these EMG signals to modulate the grip force. But the problem is, when you're gripping something with this artificial hand, you've got no feel for how much force you're applying on the object, or whether you are, you know, going to nearly crush it, or your grip force is fairly light, meaning you may drop it. So there is no real feedback, and so people have to. So the amputees or the people who use the limb have to rely on the visual feedback. Meaning you have to look at how hard you're gripping based on the visual feedback. And visual feedback is a very poor indicator of grip force. And we know from human motor control studies, that we are very optimal in controlling grip force, both from a point of view of energy and also from the point of view of being able to change things fast. So if you want to do multiple tasks very quickly, it's very hard to grip something very hard, release the grip, and then go on to the next one. You want to use an optimal level of grip. grip force. I think that's where multiple sensory modalities, proprioception, grip force, all these kind of things come into picture. Sensing is as much an important part of control as, for example, actuators and actuating mechanisms.
So, Sethu, as a maybe final question, where do you think learning is going to enter robotics first? Like in, I guess, on the market, I guess, what I mean, in actual robots being used, where is learning going to really make its biggest impact, at least in the near future?
Right. I think the biggest impact is going to be in cases where you have, when we go towards more and more multi-purpose robots, whether it's force amplification or whether it is, you know, you can think of a robot as something where even if you think of a digger or a you know, like an excavation machine, for example. There, at the moment, you operate these excavation machines purely based on visual feedback. So you apply certain force and you lift certain loads. And if things look very heavy, then you apply a bit more force and you use essentially what we call visual servoing. And I think the idea is, we are going to see more and more of what do we call shared control, meaning going away from purely either human-driven or autonomous control to something where you have a continuous sharing of both control and feedback. So a very good example can be a wheelchair system, where if you want to drive a wheelchair, which you equip it with a certain level of autonomy. At the same time, you equip it with a certain level of user feedback. So I think learning is going to play bigger and bigger roles where you are using that to integrate user feedback with autonomous systems. And just like think about the way search systems have evolved on the internet with Google and other search engines. It's evolving all the time. Meaning, the more you search for certain words, then you get a better hit on that. And the same way, I think control systems are going down that line in which you say you have a certain shared system where you have a certain underlying autonomous behavior, and then you do a certain task with that plant, and then you do online corrections based on user input. And along the way, the autonomous system itself is going to change and adapt because it's getting this constantly, it's getting this user correction. So I think the first entry into the market would be such hybrid systems, which will not be completely autonomous, but will have shared control. And I think eventually, over time, we will see more and more autonomous systems, which can effectively think for itself and make smart decisions for itself with very little external feedback.
Well, thank you very much, Sethu, for the very interesting interview.
Hey, no problems.
And all the best.
Great talking to you.
That's it for this episode of Robots. For more information on our guests, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com. And of course, don't forget to drop by the forum for discussion on today's show and other hot topics in robotics.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Learn with Robots. Podcast for news and views on robotics.